started out commercially.
Then I'm going to have District 4 third, and you guys will have. And the reason these two groups make sense for them to go next to each other is because they are dangerously close in terms of their alternative. But then you guys also have to know action, and we'll finish with that. Scary, is it? So, I think Taylor, you,
Taylor doesn't want to do this, I've been told.
TA Bosner.
No, I.
Will you do it?
I'll do it, if you guys hear me, I'll be happy.
I have a microphone. If you were here for the reiteration of the council, I'm going to make sure.
You need some tape, Ron?
Your desk is not here.
I probably do, I'll come back to that.
Banging for good reason.
You want me to find some tape or?
Okay, can I assume everybody can hear me? I'm speaking on behalf of the group that was charged with examining alternatives for a private-public partnership. So that's all these ideas focus on, a private-public partnership.
And they follow this list of bullets over here, right?
Reasonably well, yes. So the fundamental approach was to identify a landowner or group of landowners willing to accept specific management responsibility of publicly owned bison. And this responsibility would be memorialized in some sort of memorandum of agreement or memorandum of understanding that would be situated against existing law as it is today or as it would be in the future. There are many examples where private entities are authorized by a state or federal governmental entity to manage public wildlife. So this is actually a model that can work. It works in other cases and can certainly be brought to work on behalf of bison.
But you don't have to advocate for your alternative.
I was just finding out that it works. Yeah, yeah. From this approach, that's right. This is the best idea. You want to look at this idea. From this approach, there's a number of desired outcomes. Well, it's not listed here, but it is. The most important desired outcome is the establishment of a viable population that's genetically robust. And that's an important filter because everything flows from that. We indicated viability and genetic robustness based on 500 to 1,000 individuals. That's just a placeholder. Some science would indicate you actually need 1,000 plus to ensure genetic robustness. But the key here is viability. And the scale is important because everything flows from this. So other desired outcomes, once the population's in place, there's got to be hunting opportunity, access by the public, population management long-term, no disease threat to livestock. All of this has to be based on sound resource science. There has to be only an acceptable burden to the taxpayer. There's got to be ways to identify and incentivize the involvement, identify benefits and incentivize the involvement of landowners, whether it's based on public or private funds. Perhaps there could be a business model integrated into this that would allow for the private landowner to be made whole. Obviously, no impact to adjacent landowners, and consistently throughout our thinking, it's got to comport with existing law, which is best known as Senate Bill 212. I think we provided a specific code somewhere here, 0871216, that speaks to many of the things that we addressed already in existing law. The location is driven by this notion of a viable, genetically robust population. And almost certainly that means the location will involve a large tract of private land. Maybe adjacent to public land, maybe not. But nonetheless, you need a big piece of ground to achieve viability and genetic robustness. There'll be any number of specific parameters, some that we spoke to specifically. The animals would have to be contained in some capacity to ensure that conflicts were eliminated, avoided, or at least managed to resolve, all written against existing law, which again is 871216. We only listed four measures to be monitored. There'd be others when you really got into the details of this. Once again, we make reference to sound resource science, on range condition, whether there was an invasive species problem as a result of the bison operation, clearly air tracking, animal population size, disease monitoring, again, which touches back to this notion that no threat to livestock. We recognize some disease is acceptable, but there can't be a threat to livestock. Certainly a threat that's being ignored is unacceptable. And then you do things like monitor the spatial use of the bison to make sure that containment is actually working. Similarly, a number of decision triggers that might flip to one management scheme or another. The drought is important. And if there was unacceptable degradation in the range because of numbers, you might have to trigger a rather intensive management scheme in the presence of drought. All of those would be monitored as part of an accepted management plan. I want to come back to this at the end. This is, I think, what we thought was the most important piece of the whole puzzle. And that while you can develop a great plan that's good in black and white on paper, it's got to be implemented well. We thought the very best way to implement would be against a citizens management committee that would be authorized to manage the daily grind going forward. And that's what this is all about. And probably is, once you get past this notion of viability and genetic robustness, this is the other, I think, central piece of our discussion. The committee could consist of a local government, state government officials, livestock representatives, wildlife advocates, tribal representatives, local landowners, etc. But it would be a properly composed committee that would have authority to ensure that the field biologists on the ground were keeping the promises that were made. And that's what all of these simply speak to. A model that you could consider on your own time, and Tom can speak to this in detail. Where's Tom, friends? We're mindful that this was a central piece of a program that was advanced years ago to reintroduce grizzly bears to Central Idaho. A citizens management committee that would have authority to ensure that the promises made were kept. And that's that. We really didn't discuss a great deal. We didn't spend a lot of time discussing a test situation, but all of this could be constructed against an experimental scheme that would allow for an easy exit strategy. 87.1.216 already speaks to that. It's already an existing code. If you wanted to pursue this in an experimental capacity, it's important that it be properly scaled so that the data you collected and the knowledge you gained was actually reliable. Properly scaled study of this kind would almost certainly involve an extended period of time and a large number of animals. Otherwise, the knowledge you gain may not be reliable. And that could be something like a 10-year experimental study and hundreds of animals to make sure indeed you can manage across a big landscape. And Jenny, that's about all we had.
Okay, you're right.
Oh. And thank you, Taylor. And again, this was all focused on identifying a landowner or group of landowners that were willing to accept specific management responsibility of publicly owned bison-considered wildlife, done obviously in close collaboration with Montana Fish and Wildlife Parks.
Thank you. So clarifying question.
Could I?
I'm only taking questions from the discussion group, Linda.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Clarifying questions, please. Jim.
I have a question with regard to the Citizens Management Committee. With a large block of private land and one landowner, do you think that landowner would agree to work under the constraints of a Citizens Management Committee?
I can speak from my own personal experience. We do it all across the country. Now, admittedly, I work for an unusual boss, but I'll let Dick speak from APR's perspective.
Would you? Well, Jim, the devil's in the details, obviously. And so I can't speak for APR because we came up with this idea out of whole cloth yesterday and today. Clearly, that's one of the challenges. But we did speak briefly to this. I'm looking for it. The incentives and benefits for any landowner would have to outweigh the things that that landowner is giving up. And I don't mean necessarily money at all. It can be any number of things that creative minds could come up with. One other thing that I think Mike mentioned that maybe needs a little finer point is this management committee would have to be formed after the plan outline was agreed to. So they'd have to be committed to upholding the plan. Someone mentioned in our group, you don't want this committee to be half people who want it to work and half who don't. The objectives have to be set, it's got to be clear, and everyone's got to be on board to actually make the plan work. It would be a lot easier in that regard than trying to come up with the plan by this committee.
So to answer Jim's question, I'm going to ask other members of the discussion group if you can think of sort of comparable or analogous situations. Because what you're asking, Jim, is if I'm the private landowner, am I going to give my authority to that committee? Are there other situations? And that would go to one landowner versus the other that you said, which it might be three or four landowners that sort of share the stewardship or that kind of thing. So I'm going to ask Jim if anybody knows of situations where that is the case. Some conservation plan is taking place on a private piece of ground, and there or several private pieces of ground, and there's an advisory group that helps with that. Ron, you have your hand up first.
I would offer the Pedro management area in Region 7, and I think that's Powder River County, where there is a formal cooperative memorandum of understanding between private landowners and public agencies for commonly agreed management.
Okay, so there's an example, and the landowners are okay. I mean, they're part of it.
Yeah.
They're signatories. Okay.
You might want to send the mic around for that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
You might want to send the mic around for Ron's comment. I don't think everyone's.
Sorry, we need to send the mic around. So, are there other examples?
My example is actually, it's out of state, but I know of examples where, similar to what Ron has said, there is, actually an NGO working with landowners, and it's more of a conservation plan, and which those exist everywhere. But in this relationship, it actually doesn't work. So not to beat it up, but I guess my point would be, I think, that it would be key that the landowners maybe were a part of that council.
Yes, yes, yes.
Just to try to alleviate, exactly what Jim is saying, it would be hard to mitigate that. So I think as long as those guys were, signatories, as Jenny said, that it would be workable.
I get to see this kind of stuff across the country a lot.
These kinds of ideas. This is unusual. This won't work in most places. Jim, you're right. You're asking a landowner to give up to a citizen management committee. I can give you an example for a landowner's given up to a state agency or a federal agency, but this is yet one more step removed from me being able to do on my ground what I want to do. This is not something that you will, I don't think, can find easily implemented in many places of Montana. It might fit one or two cases. But this is a heavy lift for any landowner to accept. And not only is this difficult for them to accept, this demands a lot of the landscape which drives size. And I don't think there are many tracts of private land that would be big enough to hit this number. And then you gotta have a landowner that comes up with this. This is a tough puzzle to assemble. It might fit in some places in Montana, but it's a tough puzzle.
Again, we're not necessarily evaluating and dumping alternatives. We're just right now looking at, that's one thing you probably could expect from the public. Identify a landowner or a group of landowners not only willing to accept the specific management responsibilities, but also willing to work under the umbrella of the advisory committee. That's part of the alternative.
And this would be a business proposition from the start. We're saying these benefits and incentives, whatever they're going to work out to be, that landlord goes, okay, I'm willing to accept this group because I think that as a business proposition, this is going to work for me. And, you know, 10 years down the road, maybe he says, I don't like this anymore, we're going to quit. But, I mean, there is an exit strategy, but it's a business proposition.
Okay. So, any other observations? Jim, thank you for that question. That was useful to help ferret it out. I don't mean to use the word ferret in this group. So, are there any other observations you would make about this alternative? Yeah, nice job. Thank you very much, you guys. Would the people who did this alternative stand up? Please, we give you a hand. Woo! And they're good looking. What a, you know, and have on nice shirts. Are you next, young man?
It's nice to be called a young man.
Well, it's because you might be younger than I am.
I know. I got a birthday coming in a week that's going to make me old man. Each of you should have a copy of our handwritten notes. We didn't put it on big posters, nice as these guys have done, but we thought at least you have a set of notes to follow. And this approach is not the public-private partnership. This approach is basically the government-to-government partnership that focuses on tribal governments, between the state of Montana and tribal governments. So this approach is going to take on a little different look. The approach and philosophy here would be to, one, respect tribal sovereignties and their culture, to build a new relationship with the tribes, and the last two are pretty important, I think. Restore bison to Indian country. There's a strong feeling among tribal governments that culture, that heritage, that whole issue was taken away from them in the 80s, and they've never gotten it back. So I think that motivation could possibly make this a pretty viable option. And also to restore tribal cultural connections with their bison. That was one of the things that was super important to the tribal governments, was as there was a big, strong, cultural, ethical connection to the bison that at least in our group seemed worth trying to build on and connect to. Second thing, desired outcomes. This agreement would be negotiated with each interested tribe that would meet some certain parameters, and these are similar to our guiding principles, but there'd have to be some hunting parameters, cultural considerations, tribal consumption. This is mainly related to the consumption of the bison meat and bison byproducts, revenue sharing with related to the hunting aspect, management responsibilities, strategies for conflict resolution. And these bison would be managed inside the boundaries of the reservation. That would be the boundary. As far as locations, possible locations, our group decided it probably needed to be a tribe in Montana. I mean, there are lots of tribes around the country that might be interested in something like this, but at least for this discussion, we're limiting it to any tribe in Montana that can meet these criteria. Simply because this would be an agreement between the state of Montana and a sovereign government, i.e. a tribal government of some kind. Parameters and constraints. Everyone in the negotiations would have to agree on parameters and constraints that I'll list here in a minute. But they would also have to figure out how to build the capacity of the tribes to help the model be successful. And some of these national groups probably could help do that. American Bison Society, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, National Bison Association, ITBC, the Intertribal Bison Committee, I guess it's called. And there was one other one. WCS, what does that stand for?
Wildlife
of Wildlife Conservation Society. And some of these constraints that would have to be agreed on, I think, to get buy-in would be containment, population control, disease-free status, genetics, a public hunting element, respect for private property, etc. The list is not exclusive to these items. I think these would be issues that have to be developed. Measures that have to be would need to be monitored and decision triggers. Measures to be monitored and decision triggers kind of go hand in hand in a way, because once you decide on your measurement metrics, your decision triggers will be tied to those metrics. I mean, that seems to me they almost go hand in hand. Once you decide on the metrics, the measurement metrics, then the decision triggers follow along accordingly. And this would include things like, these issues would be, some would be a state requirement, some would be a tribal government requirement, because you've got a government-to-government negotiation here. Number of tribes involved could be a consideration. Number of happy public and tribal hunters, the number of conflicts that might occur, number of tribal families who benefit, and how this extends into the entire tribe as far as how the bison are used within the tribe. And then the economic side of this would have to be considered, economic activity within the tribal community related to bison entrepreneurship and tourism. And then finally, the land health stewardship would become an issue. We did have a discussion on what kind of a population would it take to be successful. And some tribes already have a lot of bison and some don't. But I think the number that Urban came up with was around 1,000 head was kind of a trigger point to really maintain the genetics. And I think that's kind of confirmed with this group over here too, if you're going to have some kind of genetic consistency and purity, and land and health and stewardship as well would have to be considered. The involvement process, we think that our group decided that probably there had to be a twofold approach. The tribe would probably have to lead public meetings on the reservation, because their government, their members of their tribe would have to have buy-in in the process, and the state of Montana would have to simultaneously do the same thing, because these bison, when they come into the state of Montana, are public property, and we assume that the tribe would take ownership of the bison. Now that might not be as easy as we think, since they would be transferred as state of Montana property to tribal property, but we got the feeling, again, from Urban, that the tribes would want to own the bison in some way, shape, or form. Is that not correct?
I guess it just kind of even goes back with, from their lands, just as a couple of, it would be a hard sell to a citizen on his own land there, having somebody else bring him in and somebody else has all the same. That's kind of what the tribe would be.
And then there would have to, once these public meetings take place, and there's buy-in from the tribal government side and buy-in from the state of Montana side, and hopefully then the government-to-government partnership agreement can be developed. And one thing that came up that was a little bit different, but I think a pretty good idea, was the fact that once we get to this point and an agreement is reached, there'd be some kind of a bison summit, statewide or national bison summit, to where this could be explained to the public what we're trying to do here, so that I think we all know what emotions can do and perceptions can do, and it's kind of like a wildfire when the wind blows. And the bison summit might help get something like this kicked off, particularly if there's buy-in through public meetings ahead of any kind of a potential agreement. As far as a possible test, I think that, an interested tribe, some of these tribes are way further along with this kind of thing than others. Fort Peck was mentioned because of its experience. Near Glacier Park was suggested because of the tourism potential, visitor potential, but really any interested tribe would, you know, if they can, you know, go by these this kind of criteria and our guiding principles, I don't think that any tribe in Montana would be restricted to participation. So that's kind of a summary of our discussion. I know Senator Phillips thinks he's got the best ideas. This is a pretty good one too. I'm kidding. We sit in the Senate together, so we exchange ideas all the time. But
I think you've said that on the Senate floor. I think Mike always thinks he has the best.
Yeah, I probably have said that. I'm pretty transparent. That's been one of my weaknesses.
One of the things I really like about this is that as citizens, we can actually see two members of the legislature that might appear on opposite sides of an issue hit each other and work together. So this actually, as a citizen, I kind of like this.
You too. Well, so we do it a lot.
Are there clarifying questions for this group? Anything you didn't quite understand? Ron Moody, please.
Speak up, Ron. We're going to bring you the mic.
In your proposal, anything new that would be a benefit to the Montana public hunter, different from what already exists in tribal bison hunting opportunities that already exist?
So that might be a question about that people right. would have about this alternative.
We actually had that conversation in our committee. What's in this for the public hunter, because you're taking public wildlife, putting them on a reservation, giving the reservation the ownership, and we talked about this a lot, and part of the negotiations we think would have to be public access and some public hunting permits for the bison on the particular tribal lands they're on. I mean, I frankly don't think this will fly if there isn't something in here for the Montana public hunter. Irvin, do you want to say anything more?
Yeah, we talked about, you know, like on Blackfeet there right now, we do sell, you know, to outside people permits for hunting. So it's something that I think that we, within putting a plan together, that we just have to sit down and try and really work those out, that there has to be those to make it a goal, that there would be those outside hunting permits that would be allowed there. And since that's in place, as far as tribes, Blackfeet, and I think other tribes too, that's a thing that would be put in it. And so we have that there already of selling, you know, for the elk, sheep, you know, and those are in place there within our fish and game regulations.
So the difference here would be the actual ownership of the animal that's transferred from state animal. For example, on your reservation, do you own the black bear, or is it still considered a state animal?
No, that's tribal.
Oh, then I'm off base. So you have jurisdiction over those animals on the reservation. They don't belong to the state of Montana.
They belong to tribal.
Okay. So.
And on that point, with the private landowner would never own the bison. We understand. So that's an important distinction.
So an interesting thing to me about these two alternatives is that they both poke a little bit at current paradigms. One, and Jim Peterson brought it up, the idea that if I'm a private landowner, should I let other people help make decisions about what's going to happen on my land? So that sort of pokes at my private property rights paradigm. I'm not giving it to the government, but I'm letting my neighbor talk about it. And then on this one, the business related to putting bison on tribal lands, the paradigm that Ron brings forward is the one that exists about if it is an animal that came from the state of Montana, was it a public animal, and should I not retain the right to hunt it? That's a paradigm that's in place. So I keep thinking about Keith's comments yesterday about new ways of thinking about some of this, that those are the issues that are sort of those value issues and that kind of cause us to
back away from some of these. So I really appreciate the fact that these two groups, at least getting started, have brought forth some alternatives that would cause all of us to maybe think about things in a little different way. Please, Ron.
Yes, Jenny.
Well, I'm going to give you this.
I did not intend to direct my question towards the change of ownership of the bison if it's moved from Montana to the reservation. The question really goes to, does the Montana public citizen maintain an interest in what is done with that bison once it goes to the reservation? Or do we surrender all interest?
So that's a good question.
And I think the answer to that question is we have a lot of discussion in two areas. One is access for hunting, and two, revenue sharing. And I think both of those, I mean, this is not new between the state of Montana and tribal governments. Those, these kinds of negotiations already take place, particularly on the retail side, or sales of retail stores. Well, tobacco is a good example. So I think that this is not totally new territory, but it had to be negotiated between the two governments.
Yes, and that negotiation is the new element here. Because when I was on the commission and we transferred 64 head of bison to the Fort Peck and Fort Belknap, we surrendered all interest control of those bison. And now we're talking about something a little bit different. What, I don't know, but something a little bit.
So remember, one more time, we're not trying to evaluate the pros and cons of the alternative, but just be clear about what this group is suggesting. And I think, Keith, you had your hand up, and then Mike asked, you were the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks person helping this group, so you have a comment also.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was going to clarify, a couple things. There are models out here, this sharing rights, if you want to call it that way. If you actually think about the tribe that exercises hunting rights outside Yellowstone Park right now on state animals. So it's kind of the flip side of this whole thing. So there are examples. And then some of you may be more familiar with the CSKT in Flathead Lake, but I just happened to buy a combination license last week. And, you know, I'm buying a license that actually gives me fishing privileges and rights on Flathead Lake given by the CSKT and the state of Montana. So there's a lot of precedent for this. We just got to figure the details out.
It is complicated, far more than my simplistic conclusion.
So there's a technical detail here that is worth mentioning. It's a little bit complicated, but it's worth everybody understanding, I think. Wildlife is not owned in the sense that other things are owned. Wildlife is not owned. I mean, you can think of it as collective ownership, collective public ownership, but technically in the law, wildlife's not owned by anyone. It's managed. Wildlife is managed in the case of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. That FWP is the trustee for the managing the public trust that is wildlife. And so outside reservation boundaries, that's the situation. Inside reservation boundaries, and I don't think Herb would disagree with this, the jurisdiction belongs to the tribe. So it's a jurisdictional thing rather than an ownership thing. I think it's kind of an important technicality.
That was helpful. Will you finish this and then we're going to go on?
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. You know, I just wanted to mention that, you know, of not owning the animals, and that's a tribal culture also. We do not claim ownership of animals, and that's a really big part of our culture. I'm glad that Mike brought that up. But it just did, it goes back to those within the jurisdiction of the tribes, they have their sovereign right to, you know, have jurisdiction of whatever hunts or goes on there. But that is a big thing. I mean, that's it. I was glad he brought that up.
Thank you.
It's,
and we could think of us as such as later. Now the parks have jurisdiction over the animals that live within their boundaries as well. So thank you, both of you, for helping. So with the people who were in this
room, stand up. Vicky's already up. Nice job. So it's about 8 minutes to 12. Should we do another one, or do you want to get your lunch and come back? We're going to get our lunch and come back anyway, but what do you want to do?
Let's do another one.
Okay, all right. Thank you. So who was number three? Up. And by the way, would you just be here a minute? This person has been so helpful from the very start. And when it came to food, you rearranged the tables, you did all that stuff. I want to say thank you, President. And so, Lori, I'm hoping you'll pass that on to the hotel too, since you did the contract with them and stuff. So we made a little decision back here that might affect you, but oh well. We're going to have lunch at 12:30 instead of 12. That way we can get all these finished before lunch. Then we'll go out there, get our lunch. They didn't want to set it out in the sun. They wanted to make sure it stayed okay. We'll get it, bring it back to the table. Then we'll talk briefly about funding, and Mike, you'll talk about where we go from here with the group. Okay? Does that work all right? Thank you. And for the people who bought their lunch, who are buying the taco lunch today, it will be down in the breakfast room at 12:30, the same as the other one. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, so we didn't have a scientist in our group, such as Senator Phillips or Keith Bonney, so our approach was different. And rather than thinking about genetics or viability, we thought about grass. And yesterday we focused mostly on a small alternative that would involve a small number of bison, but on a defined grassland landscape where there are no conflicts with livestock grazing. So presumably where livestock either haven't grazed or are not grazing present. You can take that concept and write it a little larger. And so today we spent most of our time talking about the large option. And our approach was that the state or a group should survey the state and find the largest block of grass, public or private, where there are not conflicts with wildlife, with livestock grazing. And so that's the approach, is defining a landscape where we're not dropping bison in on top of an existing cow operation and creating a conflict situation. And so that survey is a step, but we also said, let's not kid ourselves. You know, we kind of know where that is. And we do know that Charles M. Russell is there. We do know that UL Bend, which is a component, has never been grazed. It's 55,000 acres. We do know there are allotments that have been closed that are contiguous, and APR has some land that's contiguous. So we say that just in openness, you know, let's not fool ourselves, and there may be other landscapes, but we really don't know where they are. So once you've determined or identified your landscape, then the next step is you build your herd objective, your population goal, out of the available grass. And, you know, that's partly art, it's partly science. Yesterday we heard people talk about one animal to 25 acres, one animal to 50 acres. Whether, you know, somewhere in there, I used one animal to 100 acres,
kind of back of the napkin calculation, just to have a conservative approach where you have a high level of certainty that even in drought years, you're going to have grass available for your animals, and they're never going to feel the need to go over the hill to find breakfast. So if you know, just to give everybody an idea, if you're figuring you got 100,000 acres of grass without present conflicts, that translates to a herd size of 1,000 animals. So approach philosophy, one component of that is to develop, as you're doing this, some sort of worst case or emergency strategy. This is Montana, land of extremes, climate of extremes. Again, our notion is to not set up a situation where we know we're going to have conflict with agricultural operations. So as part of your analysis, you're thinking about, well, what's the three driest years in the 30s, and what did the grass resource look like? And if that happens, you may have been conservative, but what are you going to do? You know, how do you get out of the mess that's out there? So trying to think about that ahead of the worst drought you've ever seen seemed to us to be a good idea. Fire is another thing to plan for. What happens if 30,000 acres of your reserve burns in a year? What do you do? Okay, then desired outcomes. No conflicts with the adjacent livestock operations. The largest achievable herd size. So you're really trying to go big based on your grassland resource. Some sort of successful cooperative management. And I'm going to editorialize here since Mike's group borrowed the citizen management idea from Idaho, which we helped create back in the 90s, working with timber associations, individual timber companies, and the labor unions that were at the potlatch operations in Lewiston. And part of the success of that was that the leadership within the logging industry, they really kind of like the idea of grizzly bears. And they kind of like the idea of saying logging is compatible with having bears and wolves and elk. And they were all hunters, or most of them. They liked the idea of abundant wildlife populations. And so we were all kind of pushing in the same direction that way. I always used to joke with them. What they really wanted was to go out to the logging operation in the early, early morning and find a grizzly bear sleeping under the cat, shooing him away so they could get to work. And I said to my group that the ranchers in central eastern Montana have been very successful in convincing me they don't want bison under any circumstances. They think they're incompatible with the livestock operations. And so that kind of going in it to achieve the same goal, that's to me a little more elusive when we start talking about cooperative management. And the comment was made, you kind of need to do the plan first and have everybody agreeing that those are the objectives. And at its simplest for this alternative, the objectives are the largest grassland landscape you can find with no existing conflicts, and then identifying the largest herd size that landscape can support. And we appreciate there's art in that as well as science, but you're thinking big. Okay, so those are kind of the two key. No conflicts, largest herd size, some successful cooperative management, citizen management. We think a desired outcome is certainly improved local relationships and attitudes and a better cooperative atmosphere in and around this landscape. A desired outcome for us is maximum hunting opportunities for both publics and the tribes. And I think it's, you know, we feel, and this is the National Wildlife Federation speaking here, that it's that if we're able to create a large herd in the prairie landscape of Montana, that there has to be some agreement, negotiation, discussion with the Plains tribes about a part of the offtake, a part of the hunting resource available to them. And I'll just give you a figure that startled me. In the Yellowstone, where we're trying to get late season hunts, a few hundred permits, 200 I think, I'm not even sure, but there were 10,000 applications for those permits last year. And so if you think about, you know, maybe you're taking 100 bites in a year, and you're, unless you're guaranteeing or creating something for the tribes, you know, you're going to get 30 tribal members applying and 10,000 public hunters applying, and you're just not going to provide that unless you plan for it. But we want maximum public hunting and tribal hunting opportunities, which again speaks to herd size. Develop and utilize a resource monitoring system to determine adaptive and emergency management decisions. That's a desired outcome, so that we're game planning the next steps in this. Constraints. And specify a clear and enforced containment strategy. Has to be specific, clear, and enforceable through cooperative management. So we, in our group, you know, the parameters we see are severity of an incident outside that breaks your containment down, the number of incidents, including severity, and then the timeliness of the response. But yeah, that's certainly something that's a constraint. Funding has to be there. Again, clear, specific, and we think primarily public, so that you're not relying on the capriciousness of NGOs to fund key parts of this program that need funding. And it needs to be budgeted for the life of it. You need to have some sense that it's going to be there for the foreseeable future, whatever that means. We did talk as a group about a five-year review. So maybe your funding window is for that 5 years for sure. We recognize you can't guarantee everything through time. And then another constraint is property damage. And FWP is responsible. We recognize that FWP may work with the Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Wildlife Federation or other groups for additional funding, but they're responsible. So that the landowners know who that person, that agency is. Measures to be monitored, effects on wildlife and habitat, need a baseline study so you know what you're monitoring against. Local perceptions and local and social cultural changes. So you're monitoring that. You know, maybe you do a baseline survey and along the High Line before you start this, and you come back in 5 years and see whether people feel better about what you've done or worse. Decision triggers, wildlife and habitat based on your monitoring, disease monitoring, success of the containment strategy. Success of hunting as a management tool. We threw in, this is important, decline in tax base or property values. You know, it's certainly a legitimate local concern, so why not monitor it so that you're able to judge it? And if you see tax values fall or tax revenues to a county fall, and it's traceable to a bison herd or a bison area, that's something that's triggering some sort of management review. And also, related to that, an increase in local costs. Do you have to jack up your law enforcement budget because you've got additional people coming to the area? Is the local search and rescue having to do additional fundraising? So those are things you want to monitor. We spent a lot of time on this, but at the end of our discussion, we recognize that in the CMR area, we have one known entity. Well, we have several entities that are actively trying to buy additional habitat for grass reserves. And so it's possible and it may be likely that the available grass could grow. And if the available grass grows and you're trying to have a maximum herd based on the available grass, does your herd objective grow? We did say no until at least 5 years has passed. You're going to try and fix your objective to a five-year window, and then you kind of go through all of these things. If there's more grass available because of a Fish and Wildlife Service action on CMR or an acquisition of an adjacent property, that's the time you address whether you want to grow your reserve and grow your herd, or one or the other. And we also recognize that perhaps a landowner would come in and say, right off the bat, I want in, I'm going to outfit this, and it's going to make me money. And 5 years later, he said, that didn't work so well. I want out. And then there needs to be a response in terms of what your herd objectives are. So, there. I think that's it. Dean?
I did have one other. And the measures should be monitored. I thought we had in there the economics of the local communities in that area. And more so than just declining tax base and property values, it's how does the business, the local business, change?
Yeah.
Because the inputs in that local area are less with recreation than lifestyle production.
So, and you may have that in your notes that you did on the computer,
yeah.
But Chelsea, I just want to make sure that that's strengthened to make sure that the local economic state.
I know.
I just
and then she ran out of space, and Dean showed up and said, no, put that in there.
I know. And I know that these guys talked a lot about local, cultural, economic, etc. And I just want to make sure that the words are strong enough that it doesn't get diluted. Okay? Thank you. Clarifying questions.
I just have one other thing I wanted to add.
Sorry.
Resource monitoring system would be a predetermined scientific-based monitoring system that would be used to do for herd size and habitat monitoring and the effects of the other wildlife in the area.
And so you're talking about making sure that those are listed both in the measurements and the triggers. And again, I think you've got it all on the computer, they just didn't have time to, but we'll make sure all of that's in there. Absolutely, or you can take over. So, clarifying questions for this group, have you referred?
I'm not sure it's more of a common question. Property damage, that's obviously a key consideration, I think, regardless of any of these alternatives, is how we're going to address that. And I think FWP being responsible makes sense, and in order to do that, we're going to need legislative authority to be able to compensate for that, because right now that doesn't exist. Our game damage laws are real specific to the type of damage that we can compensate for, and it wouldn't include
Okay,
so,
that's good to know.
And obviously the funding is going to be key. I don't think we can bet on the come that we're going to have NGO funding to support that. I think you want to consider whether you want sportsman funding that or general fund to fund something like that, because in some ways it goes beyond a sportsman's interest as well.
Right.
So, Pat, what you've done, if we can call a law a paradigm, there's another paradigm. How do we look at compensation for damage, and where do bison fall within that? In addition to the business, kind of goes to Ron's comment about interest of the public hunter. You know, it's a pretty clear picture how licenses are used, and so that would all have to be sorted out. So that I think it's very interesting again that we can be real creative and reasonable about these. But we know there will be things that will be difficult to change. Do you know in the quality management business in organizations, remember the guy that went to Japan and did all that work? One of the main things that they found in trying to make changes, new models for just about anything, is that 85% of sort of what you could change is not available because of laws, statutes, culture, all of those kinds of things. So what you brought up here today just typifies that these are great ideas, but there will be challenges because things already are in place. So thank you. Any other, could we see who was in that group? Would you stand up, please? And Ron, who was not? And where?
Dean.
And where did Dean go? And Dean, okay.
Key part of
it. Yes, absolutely. And you can't see it from here, but they were color coordinated in their clothes. When Dean comes out, I wouldn't even notice that. All right. Thank you very much. Let's go. Rod, please.
Great. We're number four.
our group took the approach, and we actually produced two alternatives here. But we took an approach of what could you do in terms of a bison introduction project that would be the minimal change from normal rural agricultural operation way of life. Kind of a minimalist approach. And we titled this a private land centered relocation alternative. And our philosophy that we express here is that we will proceed with an FWP Bison EIS with an alternative that fairly considers and addresses all the relevant interests. And from that flows everything else here in terms of desired outcomes. Our broad desired outcome is to introduce a managed experimental population of bison someplace in Montana in a manner that sustains the existing rural communities and land resources. So we're not just talking about putting bison someplace, and the rest of this, a lot of it's going to be very familiar from the previous three presentations, but we want to do this in a way that's good business for both the public interest and the local private and local public that will be engaged in this. Okay, our desired outcomes specifically would be that we sustain and improve range conditions. We don't want to do a worse job of managing range lands than is presently being done by the private livestock industry. To public access to a quality fair chase hunt needs to be a product of whatever we do, and that real economic benefits do accrue to the local economy, and we'll speak to more of that here. We want to see the project self-funding. We want it to have its own revenue flow, and that we will minimize impacts to adjacent lands not in the project area, and that the program sustains bison numbers within our objective. So desired outcomes, both broad and specific. Location criteria. All the habitat components are in place for year-round bison use. Hopefully we would locate to find both topographic and geographic features that contain bison in the desired location while allowing free movement of bison within the area. And this reminds me of part of our original concept when I said minimum change from existing processes out in rural Montana right now is that we're trying to visualize how to manage and contain bison without extraordinary fencing, extraordinary physical structure. Okay. Location criteria, I just started on that. All the habitat components in place in one place for year-round bison use. The topography is complementary. The location has to be large enough to support the objective. Going right back to, we can get specific with the, what you were talking about, right? And the location, this is specific to our philosophy that the location is supported by local people who agree to participate in the project and a local steering committee. You don't want to dump bison in a hospital social department. Specific parameters, management. We would operate with a management board with both project landowners and adjacent landowners with appropriate public agency officers. This was how we treated this question of a local committee. It is basically we identified key people we know should be on a local committee and left it open-ended beyond that the participating landowners have to be part of that committee, and I think you'd want at least one adjacent landowner along with the appropriate public agency officers. We would like to see in the beginning that we would start off with an experimental project that would sunset in 5 years, that has a front-end agreement that participants in the project agree not to litigate the project, that early exit process is established in the beginning, and that we initiate the project with an economic and stocking analysis of the proposal in the beginning, what we expect to happen, what would be the economic analysis, what is the stocking livestock operation situation before you put rice in there, and that we have a mutually agreed process for transparency in place among all the parties involved. Measures to monitor actual financial performance versus the initial analysis that I just mentioned should be monitored. The economic outcomes to the community should be monitored. Rangeland health, of course, should be monitored. The bison herd health and dynamics itself should be monitored. And lastly, social acceptance among all the constituent groups involved should be closely monitored, as you proceed. Useful involvement process. The way we define this is, what good could come out of engaging in this kind of project in terms of relationships among people? So annual transparent report on the project to the public would be a good device for promoting, cultivating involvement among the people involved. And to encourage, engage social acceptance among constituent groups for people of other constituent groups would be a beneficial outcome of the involvement. Decision triggers. Movement of bison outside the tolerance zone of the project would trigger decision, as would excess population growth, again, fire, weather, drought, loss of habitat, and disease detection. Any of those would require decision. Lastly on this, the possible test situation within this approach, I think we could test the different types of hunting activities and structures. We can test for different techniques of range management, because putting bison on a piece of range and leaving them there is going to be different from modern scientific wildlife management, where you have risk rotation movement around pastures. So that would require some experimentation and containment strategy. We would almost certainly be experimenting with new ideas on containment in anything we do. So to conclude this one, coming back, the idea was to visualize how we could introduce bison where they are currently not present in a conservation scenario with the least disruption of current livestock industry on the landscape. And in the beginning, we are presuming that we can negotiate a viable business deal with one or more private landowners. Because, it's a normal business practice for one livestock producer to lease or rent grazing from another producer. We're trying to stay as close to that existing business model
as we possibly can. Yesterday afternoon, not this morning, but yesterday afternoon, we had a brief conversation with, okay, why would a landowner want to do this deal when they're getting, I mean, what is it for £1,000 here now, Mike? How much are we going to have to pay these guys to make the deal attractive when they can, when they're producing beef at $2,500 a head out there? So
hey,
we'll talk about that when we get to funding.
And that could go the other direction as well.
So that's the end of that one. So we want to do clarifying questions.
Well, let's do that first, and then we'll do the no action. Clarifying questions. Observations. I thought it was very interesting that under the business of possible test situation, rather than thinking of a locality for a pilot, they thought of three very important things to test. Sort of the different way of looking at hunting. I think I can see it clearly, but the other one about
range management techniques.
Techniques and how different that is from regular game management kinds of ideas, and then the containment one.
Right.
So those are, that's a very interesting thing, that we would not just be testing, can we pilot it on the ground, but what are the very specific things we need to be testing? Thank you. So who all was in this group, and then we'll look at new action, at no action? Would you stand up, the group members, or raise your hand or something? Oh my, thank you.
So, finally, we wrote the book on doing nothing and spent half the morning doing it. No action alternative. Philosophy. Present situation is satisfactory. Don't change anything. Pretty simple.
Fair enough.
Desired outcomes. The current bison conservation and hunting opportunities that already exist on tribal, private, and Department of Interior lands will continue. Local and state economies continue on the established proven model. People stay on the land. And what this is implying is that a bison project will displace people from the land. Avoid a local urban conflict over a bison location. Avoid possible conflicts between other wildlife species that will be displaced by bison when you put them on a location. And rangeland management will continue with proven livestock practices already known and familiar. And operating, objecting landowners, by that I mean a landowner objecting to the presence of bison within their universe, who are currently saying that if you introduce bison in my area, and I'm in block management, I'm going to resign from the block management program. So those people will choose to stay in block management because we didn't do anything, and their objection was relieved. And lastly, by doing nothing, we would hope that we would gain time to heal the cultural conflicts that have been exacerbated to this point and build on the lack of trust that we have recognized yesterday currently exists. Undesired outcome. Whoa, I just discovered the microphone. Undesired outcomes. Social conflict will continue over conservation values not addressed by not introducing bison. Urban-rural divide between urban Montanans and rural Montanans will widen. And what this is saying is the people who are advocating for bison introduction are not going to go away. They're not going to stop advocating, so the conflict will continue. We will miss any economic benefit that has been proposed by introducing bison,
by not introducing bison. State and local people could lose their voice in control of bison reintroduction in Montana should a unilateral federal action occur. If we don't do it, and in some near or distant future day, a unilateral federal action takes place, then we will have no ownership control of that process. And it could prompt an effort to list bison under the Endangered Species Act. That is our best vision of the pluses and minuses that we might see if we simply choose not to do anything.
Thank you.
I'll stop there.
Clarifying questions about the no action? Please.
Just one comment. I serve on the PLPW Council, as Chris does, and Dwayne Andrews does work for FWP and signage, and where you were talking about just block management, his comments to the council meeting to avail of not just block management, people dropping out, bison introduced in eastern Montana. A lot of landowners who now allow access are going to drop out. He said he may be putting up a sign that says where there is access and right on the other side of the road, there are big signs that say no bison reintroduction. So I just want to say that it's more than just block management. The block management is only about 7.3 million acres in Montana. There's a lot more acres than that that private property owners allow access to.
So once again, the relief would be the relief from the threat of losing access, either permission or through block management. Okay. Any other clarifying questions or observations?
If I could editorialize just this much, it is I would like to encourage everybody to really take home the thought behind this item number 3, which is state and local people could lose their voice in control of bison reintroduction should a unilateral federal action occur. I think that is the real significant negative possibility that when you are deciding that my stand is going to be no bison, no way, that we're really putting ourselves in the same position that we were in 1993 and 94 in regard to wolf reintroduction, which is we could have done it our way before the Department of Interior decided to do it their way in Yellowstone Park, and we would have had much more control of what happened with wolves in the subsequent years if we had taken that leadership action before the other action happened.
Thank you.
Think about that.
Thank you. I really appreciate this group, and you saw who they were a minute ago. I really appreciate them doing the no action. When Rebecca or whoever ends up writing these alternatives in an environmental impact statement or dude or whoever process, the no action is a difficult one. But there are pluses to a no action, and there are negatives to a no action, just as the others. So thanks very much for being able to do that one, instead of just assuming it was out there. Nice job. We're going to break for lunch. It's exactly 12:30, which will work okay. And I'm going to give you about 15 minutes, take your plates, come back here, and then we'll finish up. But if I may, Mr. Moody, I'd like to just kind of piggyback a little bit on what you just said. And I said yesterday, you know, this kind of process is not about nice guys. This is not about, so Taylor and Jay get along with each other, or Tom and Dean get along with each other. It's not about that. It truly is about where the power lies. And when this process, which I certainly didn't invent it, it came out of the Harvard negotiation process where attorneys found that an interest-based approach to problem solving, whether it was an Atlantic Ocean fishing treaty or negotiations in a school district, that if the power was shared and used to get to a solution that guaranteed the power and interests of all the parties as much as possible, that it was a more durable outcome, it was a wiser outcome, it had more possibility as far as adaptation, because it didn't end up necessarily in the same kind of absolutes with no place to move, and relationships were better. That's the nice part. You know, you don't have a good relationship with your mother-in-law just because you want to be a nice guy. You know, you have a guy's generic to it. You have a good relationship with your mother-in-law for about 15 reasons, including the cultural health of the human pod that happens to be involved there. So I really appreciated your comments. The idea of being able to solve it together means that you keep your power. The idea of having to go to arbitration, to a law, you give your power away, and it's a crapshoot. It's a jump ball. So this process is about how do we keep as much power collectively as we can so that some of you end up on the winning side and others end up on the losing side. So very nice job on your alternative development. Let's go get some lunch, come back. And Mike, I hope this also gives you some ideas about closure and where we go from here, and being able to talk about the environmental impact statement process and kind of what's required in that as well. So let's take until 10 minutes to be back at the table with